And now, the best of health and fitness, the show that covers the health and fitness topics that matter most. Here's your host, Shani Rubin.
Good morning, listeners. I am your host, Shani Rubin. Here this morning, we have with us a featured guest. He is an expert polygraph examiner and a private investigator. He also appears on the Steve Wilko Show on NBC, and his credentials are overwhelming. Where do I begin? Let me welcome you, Mr. Daniel Ripikoff. Good morning, Daniel. How are you today?
Hi, Shani. Thank you very much. Very well, and I hope you're well, too. And good morning to all the listeners. Very, very nice to be on your show, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners and give them some insights this morning.
Thank you, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. I know that you're a very busy gentleman.
My pleasure.
Okay, so why don't we start with telling the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I've been a private investigator for almost 26 years now, Shani. Okay. I'm a polygraph examiner. I hold advanced certifications in polygraph and sex offender polygraph testing. I've tested everybody from professional athletes to politicians. I've conducted investigations into everything from the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 to the African embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya. I've recovered kidnapped children from the Middle East and from various parts of the United States. So I've lived quite a exciting life. And I recently wrote a book. I'm the author of a 220-page hardcover book called I Spy, How to Be Your Own Private Investigator, published by St. Martin's Press.
Fascinating. Very fascinating. Well, what inspired you to become a private investigator?
Always had the love for, the Starsky and Hutch, the Mannix, you know, for those of us who are old enough to remember those PI movies. And had the bug and fell into it. Worked as an auxiliary police officer in the NYPD for many years, where we would do patrol of every precinct in the city with a task force, and eventually came out to Nassau County to do the same. So always had the love for the police and investigative work, and made a career out of it, made a real good living out of it.
Yeah, so it's like a dream that you had as a child.
Yep, lived my dream, exactly.
Wow. Well, what makes you so successful?
I think a combination of years of business experience, so I understand the business world, caring about every case and taking it personal where it's not just another case, your problem becomes my problem, and really thinking outside of the box. So my motto has always been, if you do more than you get paid for, you'll always have a job. That's been the mantra. Over 26 years, I've never really advertised at the time where, there were no internet. I had non-published numbers, and if you didn't find me, you wouldn't find me. So it was all done by referral. I built my business really one case at a time.
Wow. Now, aside from the polygraphs coinciding with your profession, what started the passion for the polygraphs?
The polygraphs was an add-on to what I was doing. It was a tool that I used as a private investigator to cut to the chase. So, for example, we would have a theft of money in a store, and we had 20 employees.
Okay.
So the polygraph would be able to exclude suspects and say, okay, let's leave Bob and Doris and Kathy alone, and let's focus in on Tony, who failed the polygraph test, and now he becomes the focus of our investigation. So it's an excellent screening tool. And from there, I became, pretty well known for it, and eventually was contacted by media outlets at the Tyra Banks Show. I was a technical consultant for The Good Wife, for The Guiding Light, the soap opera when it was on. I've been Nat Geo Brain Games, the Today Show, and the list goes on and on. So, really took off as a sideline, but accelerated up as almost the main focus of my time now.
Right. And now you're currently on the Steve Wilko Show, correct?
Yeah, for the past 7 years. We're just wrapping up season 9. I've been the polygraph examiner for Steve, which is an NBC Universal production, and it's a syndicated show here in the New York area. It's shown on WPIX, and in various parts of the country, it's shown on Fox and other type of stations. It's actually internationally syndicated. It's seen in Canada, Australia, Ireland, England. Broadcast all over the world. Yeah. So,
I didn't know it was all over the world. Wow.
Yeah. It's internationally syndicated. So, we've got the great following. We help people. That's the real beauty of the show. It's, not a stupid show. People come to us with their problems, and we resolve them forensically for them. Murder, rape, kidnapping, child molestation, child abuse. We've had a lot of people arrested as a result of our work, and a lot of people exonerated from criminal charges because of the work that we've done on the show.
Wow, impressive.
Yeah, thank you. Steve's now, a former... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, finish.
Thanks, yeah. Steve is a former Chicago police officer and left the police force when his show became popular. So he's an excellent interviewer, great insight, good gut instinct. We're sort of like a Batman and Robin type of team.
Nice. No, that's good. It's good that you guys get along. Now, let me ask you this. How accurate is this test?
Sure. So polygraphs have been around for about 100 years. They started out in 1920.
And okay.
There's different techniques, different test types in the polygraph. The most accurate polygraph is scientifically rated at 99.4% accurate. That's the single issue test. Single issue test is, did you do it? So if you're accused of shooting the bank teller in a robbery, I would ask you, did you shoot the bank teller in the robbery? So that test is a very, very accurate test, about 0.5% less than DNA testing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's deadly. It's a deadly accurate test.
Huh. Now, do they use this test particularly in courts now?
They do in certain states and venues, and I'll tell you the reason why sometimes it's shied away from. In 20 states, it's admissible. In many federal circuits, it's admissible. In immigration courts, it's admissible. And recently, I just got a call from a United States District Court judge, a federal court judge.
Okay.
I mean, I'd like you to polygraph both parties in this case that I'm working in, and primarily due to the fact that he wants to get the truth and try to force the sides to settle, because it's a civil case. But no judge ever wants to hear cases, because if every case was heard before the court, in a jury trial, your case would come up 50 years from now. So approximately 2% of cases ever go to trial because they're usually settled or pled out.
Sure.
So polygraphs are used in the court system consistently, and the reason why some people shy away from them in court is not accuracy or reliability, but it's constitutionality. Janie, you have a right to a trial by a jury of your peers.
Right. Correct.
That polygraph instrument is not your peer. You didn't go to high school with it, did you?
So no. True.
Right. So it becomes trial by instrumentation, then, not trial by a jury of your peers. Because if I come into court and I say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Shaney failed the polygraph for robbing the bank, the jury goes, So Clarence Thomas from the United States Supreme Court says, the jury is the lie detector. You come in, they go, you don't look like a bank robber, they don't got you on camera, they don't have your fingerprints or your DNA. Okay, so you're not a bank robber.
Right.
So it disturbs, it takes away the jury's power. So that's really the reason behind people objecting to using the polygraph in court. Because if you look at court decisions, what's the accuracy? What do you feel is the accuracy of a jury verdict?
Yeah.
80%, 20%, right? It's 75% at best. So the polygraph is much more accurate, but really, the justice system is based upon reasonable doubt. And,
it makes sense. But let me ask you this. But clearly, whoever's taking the test, I'm assuming, would be really nervous. I mean, I would be extremely nervous taking the test. That wouldn't tip the results, or no, not at all?
No, not at all. Polygraphs don't measure nervousness. I don't even know where that started. right? Because if nervousness was the
It's a myth, probably.
It is a myth. Everyone would have failed a polygraph in the last 100 years, right? Because you come in, you're nervous, right?
So I would have failed it on nerves, absolutely.
Now, a polygraph doesn't measure nerves. A polygraph tells me what part of your brain you use when you answer a question. It's a it's a physiological test, a medical test. So your first name is Shaney, your last name is Rubin, and you do a radio talk show, right?
Right.
You live in New York City. How do you know that? It's in your memory, right? Did you rob a bank yesterday?
Okay, so it goes by different wavelengths that you're saying, correct?
Goes by your memory. The truth is in your memory, right? That's what the truth is. So what you've done, what you haven't done is in your memory. Have you ever taken a polygraph test before, Shaney?
No, I hope to God I don't have to.
Okay.
The thought of it makes me very nervous.
How do you know you haven't taken a polygraph test? Because it's not in your memory. So if I ask you, Shaney, yesterday, did you rob the bank? When the truth is there, you go, no, because it's not in your memory. When you want to lie to me, you can't lie from your memory. Your memory has no imaginative powers. You have to transition and use the prefrontal cortex, the forehead area of your brain, is where your imagination is. And when you lie, your brain works harder than it does to tell the truth. And the great example that I like to do is I come to your house and it's for sale and I go, how much is your house? You go, it's $200,000. Okay. Great. Here's $200,000. Thanks, Shaney. Let's transact. Or I give you $200,000 and I say, Shaney, build me a house. It's a lot harder to fabricate than it is to give. And that's the same thing in your brain. So in a polygraph, if you noticed, we're going to ask you questions we know are true. Is your first name Shaney? Right now, are you in New York City? And we gauge how much energy your brain uses when you tell the truth. And then when you lie, it's almost like revving the engine of your car. Vroom, you're going to use much more energy. Your brain's going to call more energy. So it's a medical test. You can't feel it. You can't control it.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. Wow.
Yeah, that's the way she works. And we know this from the advent of MRIs. If I stick your head in the MRI, I can watch 15 parts of your brain work when you lie and 7 parts of your brain work when you tell the truth.
Okay, well, people must experience all different kinds of emotions when the results are given, especially when they come back to find out, hey, so to speak, you're not telling the truth. Now, are there psychologists or counselors provided for these people afterwards when you give them the results?
In the show, there are. We have a psychologist on staff that works with them both before to evaluate them to make sure that they're okay to come on the show and that they're suitable candidates, for the show and the stress. And then afterwards, deal with them, both the victims as well as the examinee who may have failed. So, and they follow up also. It's called aftercare where he'll be in contact with them and make sure that everything's going well. But, the truth is,
I'm assuming they wouldn't like you very much after the results.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I got a lot of friends when they pass, when they fail. Unfortunately, the truth is the truth. And
what was the most interesting thing that happened to you after you gave the results?
on the show, people argue, people tell me, I don't know what I'm doing. What happens is a liar will continue to lie and a liar blames other people. So it's not that I lied, it's that you're an idiot, you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, of course.
So that's common, deceptive behavior. Because as a polygraph examiner, we also conduct what we call credibility assessment testing in addition. So the second you walk into the room, I start assessing your credibility because people leak deception. And I start analyzing what you say, what you don't say, how you say it. And I start to score you already. So in a polygraph, it's not only just the polygraph. It's a series of credibility assessment tests.
Right.
So I know really before I polygraph you whether or not you're going to fail.
I'm sure.
I've assessed you with other methods because as a forensic examiner, as a private investigator, I can't polygraph everybody. A lot of people refuse. So I've got to interview you. And by interviewing you, and this is great for, the girls and the guys listening today, how to assess if you're being told the truth by somebody who's trying to sell you aluminum siding, by a girlfriend or boyfriend, by your kids, There's leakage. People leak deception. And
like how? Give me an example.
So I'll give you an example, and it's sort of the premise for stop, question, and frisk in New York City, which they don't do anymore, where the police would stop you, they would question you. The media leaves out the question part because that was the probable cause for the search. Now I stop you, Shaney, in a bad neighborhood that's drug infested. And I say, huh, you know what? She doesn't really fit in this neighborhood. She's probably here to buy drugs. So I pull you over and I go, miss, what are you doing in this neighborhood? I'm going to visit my grandmother. What's your grandmother's name? Jody Brown. Mm-hmm. Where does she live? 123 Main Street, apartment 8. What are you going to do there? I'm dropping off medicine for her. Okay, go ahead. Now listen to the difference.
Okay.
What are you doing here, miss? What am I doing here? I'm going to visit my grandmother.
Right.
Hesitancy. I repeat the question. Where does your grandmother live? My grandmother lives over there in that building. What are you doing? I'm going to I'm bringing her medicine, right? Because when you lie, you have to fabricate. And when you have to fabricate, it takes you time. Comedians use it all the time by repeating the questions, and they get heckled, right? They get heckled, and they go, you know, you're a clown. The guy goes, I'm a clown. You know, now he's thinking of the response. So you heard the difference between the way people answer. You understand that they're being deceptive.
Yeah, absolutely.
A guilty person has a hard time saying no. I'll interview a person who's accused of being a child molester. And I go, did you molest that little girl? No. Right? Did you molest that little girl? Why would I molest a little girl? I have a beautiful wife. I get all the sex that I want. I don't need to molest children.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can see.
Has a hard time saying no, and they over-explain.
I'm going to look for those signs the next time I think someone's lying to me.
and you'll see they do come true. It's all in my book. But these, forensically, this is what we look for in credibility assessment, to say this person's being truthful, this person is being a liar. And I have it a lot in, polygraphs. People come up and let's say you work in a jewelry store and a diamond ring is missing. So now the boss has spoken to everybody, says we want you to go take a polygraph because we want to see if you stole the diamond ring. So, Shaney, you come to me and I go, Shaney, what is this interview and polygraph about?
Okay.
It's about a stolen diamond ring and whether I stole it, right? What is this interview and polygraph about? I don't know. My boss just told me to come here.
Yeah, I see. I see exactly. Yeah, I can definitely see the difference.
When you know what to look for, it's extremely obvious and very easy to detect deception by verbal and written, methods, because everybody's really programmed the same.
No, that's definitely some good information. But you know what? Let me just go a bit into your other achievements. Here's an honorable accomplishment that I read: being named as the NYPD Honor Legend Man of the Year. How does one inherit that honor?
Okay, the honor.
That's incredible.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, the Honor Legion in the NYPD is a organization that has been around since the 1800s and really inducts heroic police officers, regardless of their rank, who have achieved, medals of valor and commendations for, bravery. If you are killed in the line of duty, you're automatically inducted into the Honor Legion posthumously. And they also take care of the widows and the orphans of the police officers that have been killed in the line of duty. And, as a member of, the business society here in New York, as well as an artillery officer, I was always a very strong supporter of the Honor Legion and was involved in a lot of, their benefits, their charity, their fundraising, supporting the widows and the orphans. And, I received the honor of being the man of the year for them, which is one that I share with Rudy Giuliani, Commissioner Safer, Commissioner Bratton, Mayor Koch. They're all recipients of the Man of the Year.
Right.
So it's an honor that I cherish and, will till the day that I die. It's a great honor.
Well, congratulations. That impresses me. That's very impressive.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, not the average investigator, which clearly we established the fact that you're not, works on many notable cases. But now, the 9/11 was such a horrific and historical day for the world, and you were chosen as one of the investigators for that one in 1993, I believe, the World Trade Center bombing investigation. Now, what was the most interesting thing that you encountered while working on this case?
So on that case, if you know, people may not remember it as clearly as the 2001 bombing, but in 1993, a radical blind cleric, Rahman was his last name, was involved in orchestrating that bombing where they loaded up a Ryder rental truck with fuel oil and fertilizer, which is a bomb, and drove it in towards the parking garage underground in the World Trade Center and detonated it, trying to bring the buildings down, which they did not bring the buildings down. Obviously, it's a truck bomb. It's not going to bring down the World Trade Centers. So I worked on that case for several reasons. Primarily, it was for liability as to who may have been responsible for faulty systems that resulted in property damage on behalf of insurers. So I was hired by an insurance company that insured a lot of businesses within the World Trade Center. People don't really see, like, you know, how different aspects affect, you know, a bombing. So not necessarily so much who did the bombing, but how did the bombing impact their clients, because they have rare books, they have artwork, they had things that were damaged in that bombing due to smoke. And what happened was they drove the truck down into sort of this underground ramp where if you went left, you would go into the parking garage. And if you didn't want to go into the parking garage, you could just continue straight and come up from underground again. Well, the original news media was that they drove the truck into the parking garage and detonated it. And that's not true. They drove the truck down into the ramp against the wall of the parking garage and detonated it. So they never entered into the parking garage. But they blew out the walls and compartments that would contain smoke if there was a fire in the garage. They blew out the electrical panels, which the World Trade Center was pretty unique because it could receive power from Con Ed. And Con Ed's power went out, it would switch over automatically to New Jersey. So since they blew that panel out, now you had no power from New York, no power from New Jersey, and the generators that ran the ventilation system continued running until the diesel fuel at that time was depleted. So smoke started to rise through the towers almost like a chimney, and that caused a tremendous amount of damage to the items that were insured by the insurance company. So the insurance company said, see if anybody was at fault for faulty systems. Was the HVAC vendor, an installer at fault? Was the garage liable because they let this bomb into the garage? I did the liability aspect of it. So, you know, in a terrorist act or in any type of an act, there's always the insurance aspect of liability, and that's what I investigated. So by doing that, I actually had to investigate every aspect of it. So that's a very interesting case, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what was the most challenging situation that you encountered?
With that or with any other case?
With that.
With that, really not too much of a challenge because we were able to lay things out. There was a lot of documentation. And interesting fact that I had learned was the World Trade Center was put up in the 70s. And at the time, it was built to withstand hurricane force winds of 150 miles an hour and a direct strike from a 707 because that was the biggest plane that they had.
Okay.
So when the planes, hit, 757s and things along those lines in 2001, the towers actually withstood those strikes, even though it was only designed to take a strike from a 707. The towers were built very, very well. What caused the collapse in 2001 and 9/11 was the fact that the jet fuel burned for so long that it actually melted the steel girders that held the weight of the building, and then it couldn't hold the weight of the building because it was melting and just collapsed.
That was going to collapse.
Yeah, but the World Trade Centers were built very, very well.
Now, let me ask you this. Aside from 9/11, what was the, okay, since we were on the topic, what's the most challenging case that you ever encountered in general? You worked on so many.
Oh, yeah, you're not kidding. one of them was a kidnapping. I had acted as a investigator for a parental abduction on pretty much one of the earlier gay marriages. There was two gentlemen that got married, and they wound up having a baby through a surrogate, and eventually they got divorced, and one of the first gay divorces. And joint custody was given so that on the weekends, one father who lived in Boston would come down, take the child, and the child was abducted by that father from Boston. He was taken to Israel, so he was not returned after the visit. And they received an email saying, I've taken the child to Israel, and you're not getting him back. So I was contacted by the father here in New York, and began working on the case, and within 20 hours of being hired, we located that child in the West Bank town of Lapid. L-A-P-I-D is the name of the town, very, very small town by the West Bank of Israel.
And placed
the child under surveillance for 3 weeks, literally round the clock, 24-7, until they could get Hague Convention lawyers from the United States to petition the Israeli courts to honor the judgment in the United States that residential custody was given to the New York father and that the child had been abducted. And, of course, they were working with the State Department. And during that time, the father had moved the child to a very small apartment in somebody's house in Jerusalem. So if we didn't have eyes on him in the beginning, we never would have found this kid. And we kept him under surveillance until the Israeli police had the orders, and they came and took the child back, and the other father was arrested for parental abduction and a bunch of other charges.
Wow, I commend you. I mean, I could never do what you do. I'm too emotional. I would be a mess. But that's great.
It's hard when dealing with children.
It takes a strong person.
Here's
another achievement. How to become your own private investigator. You're the author of that book, correct?
Yes.
Okay. First, I need a copy of that book.
No problem. We can arrange that.
I want it autographed.
Absolutely.
Okay. As I'm sure many of our listeners want it. Okay. So what are the characteristics of someone lying? Let's start with that.
Okay. So in that book, once again, I've written this for the average everyday person for their health and for their benefit, because as you know, stress is going to affect your health. Stress
absolutely
is going to affect your life. And if you think like an investigator and have some of the skills that I have, you'll live a much better and safer life because you won't get scammed. You won't have somebody who can, come into your life and wreak havoc. So some of the characteristics of a person that's lying, we had discussed previously, and I'll review some of them and add to it as well, is the person has a hard time answering a question directly. No.
Okay.
Yes. They over-explain. They blame others. They avoid responsibility. There's latency. There's hesitancy in the answer. There's an another really good one is, if you don't answer a question, you've already answered the question, right? When people go, I'm not going to answer that question.
No answer is an answer.
Right. So if I go to you, Shaney, did you ever, lie on your application for a credit card? You go, I'm not going to answer that question. It means, yes, you have, because you refuse to answer it. So when you don't answer a question, you've already answered it. You know what the answer is.
Absolutely.
Those are signs of deception, licking the lips, swallowing, gulping, self-soothing, where a person will start to like rub their arm or rub their leg, is almost like mama rubbing the baby, going, no, it'll be okay. So people start to leak deception physiologically as well, because there are changes in the body when a person lies, and that's what we measure in the polygraph. But some of those changes are visible. So in my book, I detail a lot of them. We have diagrams to show you of how people will have body language, as well as written and verbal cues of detecting deception, because a lot of communications today are done by text or by email, and how do you know if a person's lying? Well, that's all in my book as well.
Oh, good, good. Now, do we know the percentage of the men that cheat? And the women, too. Women, too, because women cheat as well. So, you know, I want to be fair.
There's a joke. 80% of all married men cheat in America. The other 20% cheat in Europe. So that's the joke.
Well, when I asked that question to a couple of guys, you know, how many men cheat, they told me 99.9, Cheney.
That's a great something, guys. So, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty high percentage. And, you know, the Internet has made it a lot easier, because before you had to go out to cheaters clubs, and you had to go out to a bar, and then you had a hard time explaining it to your significant other where you were. Today you sit in in your underwear, and you can hit on 50 people on Tinder, Grindr, Match.com, Cheaters.com, whatever it might be. I think AOL really started it all with these chat rooms, right? You know, married but looking, and blah blah blah. For those of us who remember the AOL days.
Married but looking?
Yeah, they used to have these chat rooms, married but looking, married and wanting to cheat, and people would go in there and, you know, meet up. So yeah. That's made it a lot easier. So it has increased quite a bit, because there are a lot of, you know, cyber relationships that start and escalate. And that kind of behavior where a person never would have, you know, thought of it, it's just so easy to get involved in that, you know, they get involved and they get sucked into that world. So the least likely people, you know, have done it. I've seen it, because we do a lot of polygraphs for relationships and infidelity, as well as a lot of investigations into infidelity. And, you know, the rate has increased, and it's primarily due to the Internet.
Now, in your opinion, do you think that somebody that cheats should get a second chance?
Well, you know what, each relationship
is that a tough
different.
Question?
Yeah, because each relationship is different. It's the same thing as being robbed. You know, some people say, you know, you pull out a knife and ask me for my money, I'm going to fight you. And some people go, well, you pull out a knife and ask me for my money, I'm just going to give it to you. So everybody is different. Every relationship is different. It's hard to say what's right and what's wrong for other people. And you know, a lot of times there's a lot of circumstances where people will, hang on a quick second. Still with me? Okay. You know, some people are very hot-headed, and they go, you know, if you cheat on me, you're out of here. And some people go, well, you know what? I was neglecting my mate. I was, you know, playing golf too much. I wasn't telling her how beautiful she was, you know, and, okay, it's my fault. I understand. So let me fix myself and fix the problems that, you know, were created. So some people are very level-headed and understand, and some people aren't. So it's a tough question to answer.
Okay. Now, so we'll go to the stakeout. Now, when you're conducting a stakeout, which absolutely sounds like fun, which is in the book, how does one go about that? I mean, tell me about that.
So stakeouts are, you know, a staple of investigation. We want to be a fly on the wall. And a stakeout sounds glamorous and it sounds fun, but it's actually really the opposite. It's long. It's hard physiologically, because in the winter, you got to sit in your car. And a lot of times, you know, let's say you're in Manhattan, you can run your car. But if you're in Long Island or Westchester on a very quiet residential street, you can't run your car because you're going to see the smoke coming out of it in the winter. So you're sitting in a car and it's 10 degrees outside. and people don't realize that, you know, after 5, 6, 7 hours, you're going to have to pee. So, any good surveillance operative, whether they're with the FBI or with the NSA or with the NYPD, knows that an apple juice bottle, the Big Mouth Moth apple juice bottle, is a staple for the surveillance agent, because that's the notorious pee bottle. When you got to pee in the bottle. So it's a lot of surveillance than for guys, but I have a lot of female surveillance agents. I just don't ask questions. So you've got long, boring hours, potential inactivity, potential nosy neighbors. You know, what are you doing here? Potential intervention from the police. The neighbors call the cops, or the cops come. What the hell are you doing here? So there's a lot of variables to surveillance, as well as being able to follow the person. So oftentimes we'll use multiple agents for a couple of reasons. You're going to drive. You're going to drive to the train station, and you're going to get on the train in the morning to go to work. Well, I better find a parking spot really quick, because you know how hard it is at the train station sometimes. Because otherwise, you're going to park, get on the train, or get on the platform. I'm going to lose you. So we would have a foot guy, a foot agent, right, or a female, that when you pulled into the parking lot, they would jump out, stay with the person, and then the driver would drive, let's say, to Manhattan to be able to meet the foot agent, because now that person goes to work. And what are you going to do, stand on the sidewalk for 8 hours? You know, you're going to get a little tired. You're going to get noticed. So we have to get a car in there so that you guys can sit in the car and watch. So a lot of surveillances need multiple agents. We had a surveillance we did last week on an employee. The employer says, this guy's a manager, and he's supposed to be going around to different locations, but I don't know what he's doing during the day. I want to know. So we follow him around, but the guy drives like a nut. I mean, he's doing 60 miles an hour up 6th Avenue during the day. So, you know, you can lose a guy, and you can lose him very easily. You have to beware of not killing anyone, right? You can't break laws to follow them. So people don't understand the risks of surveillance are, you know, losing someone, someone catching you, doing surveillance and becoming cognizant that they are under surveillance. You're watching a building in the city with 6 exits. You got 2 agents, right? The guy goes out another exit, you don't see him. Or the guy comes out the crowd, and you don't see him. So you can lose a guy or never see him. There's a lot of risks to surveillance. It's a very, very difficult operation, and it really is an art form, because you have to be able to stay with the person, not be seen, not lose them.
It sounds difficult. Yeah,
it is.
I mean, it sounds like fun, but it also sounds difficult.
Yeah, if you do it day after day, you're going to get burnt out. but you know, some people love surveillance, and that's their specialty. And the agents that I have that work for me are you know, all seasoned guys. A lot of them have organized crime experience. They were in the Organized Crime Control Bureau of NYPD, and you know, they followed car thieves and mafioso around.
And
they did it for 20 years, so this is what they do. You know, almost, it's like flying a plane. You know, that's what they do.
Yeah, to them, they do it every day, sure.
Right. So there's a lot of risks to surveillance, and, you know, clients have to understand this. You know, sometimes a client will go, what do you mean you lost them? Look, in Broadway, in Times Square, it's 5 p.m., I got two agents. What do you mean, how do you lose? It's not easy.
They don't understand now.
Yeah.
Well, here's my favorite one, which I came across while researching the book. How to go off the grid now and forever. I'm assuming first stop all social media.
Yeah. Social media is the killer. People give away a lot of details. And I love social media because it's made my life a lot easier.
I love it, too.
It's great for a lot of things, but then people also give away their position. You know, it's bringing the submarine up, and the first thing is you got to stop your social media. And today it's a lot easier to track people than it was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we would get a surveillance from an insurance company that says John Smith is claiming that he was injured in a car accident and he can't work. So he lives in an apartment building in Manhattan. He's 5'8", brown hair with a mustache, and he's a Caucasian male who's 45. Okay, now everybody coming out of that building looks the same, right? Fits that description. So we used to have to try to go and do like a pretext door knock, right? You know, where we'd knock on the door and we'd give you a delivery. Hi, we're delivering samples, and we'd give like a bar of Dove soap in a box, right? And identify them. Today, I go on social media. I get his picture off of LinkedIn. I get his picture off of Facebook, and I give it to my agent. Yeah. Here, this is the guy you got to look for. So it's made it a lot easier. Geotagging tells me where you've been, right? So or where a photo has been taken. So So we can see, are you in New York? Are you in Rome? Are you in Paris? Because a lot of times you can't find somebody.
But so they can lie and tag and say they're in Paris and be sitting in Brooklyn, no?
Well, you can sort of tag yourself, but the actual geotagging, if that's on your phone, that's done by GPS. So it's embedded into the photograph. So that you can't mess with.
Can anybody get that or no? It's just police.
No, you can get it. Yeah, it's actually embedded in the photo. You just have to know how to look for it. So geotagging will tell us, you know, where you are. IP addresses, when you send an email, will tell us, you know, where you are. So it will tell us if this IP address belongs to Time Warner Cable in New York, then I know that you're in the New York area and you're not in Idaho.
Sure.
So people give themselves up in a lot of different ways. And essentially, to go off the grid, as it says in my book, you're going to have to live almost like Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, where he lived in Montana in a shack. cell phone, your account with a cell phone. I can locate you through your, cable TV, gas, electric, internet, because you have to have an account, and it tells me where that account goes to. So you might want to do that with somebody, let's say if I'm living with you, I'd put it under your name versus my name, because now I got to find, that I'm in a relationship with Shaney Rubin. So, it's harder. So you can't have stuff in your name, bank accounts, credit cards, ATMs. I had a gentleman who was an attorney and, got a bit depressed at one point. And
yeah, but everybody has a social, no?
Everybody has a social security number, right. So, we'll track you through that, through your employment, through your bank accounts. So you really have to have nothing in your name, because otherwise you are trackable.
Now, what about identity theft? Because that's pretty scary.
Oh, yeah. Somebody tried to access my corporate bank account last night. We got an email really scary. My wife got all bent out of shape. She's the CFO of my company. She gets a notification that your bank account has been locked because of too many tries. So it made us change the password, and we changed it to a much more complex one. So
that's strange that would happen to you.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It can happen to anybody.
I mean, who would try and do identity theft on you? But okay.
Yeah. Oh, they do. You know what? Identity theft is not a hard thing, and you've got to protect yourself. And in my book, we talk about that as well. We talk about not giving out vital information over the phone. You know, my wife had received the email and it said, please contact us. And it gave an 800 number. And I said, don't call that number, because somebody could send you an email saying, your account has been locked. Call this number. Then when you call, you give them information, and it's called phishing with a PH, right? They're phishing for information. So I looked up on the website, what was the number for Bank of America? It turned out it was the same number, and we called it and we got that resolved. But, you gotta be careful, because they make these scams look so real. They'll send you an American Express, your account has been compromised. Please call this 800 number. You call up.
Sure.
They say, what's your account number? What's your password? What's your mother's maiden name? Now they have it all. So, never ever call a number that they send you on an email. Always look at the back of your card, or go on the internet and look at the official site and contact them, because they could be phishing for your information. That's a very, very common way. Another thing that people don't realize is they don't shred their garbage, right? You get an offer from
that's
a credit
me.
Card. Yeah.
I have a paper shredder here and it's collecting dust. I'm guilty. I toss it in the trash.
You got to use it. Because one man's trash is another man's treasure. I've made multi-million-dollar fraud investigations and criminal investigations just from collecting people's garbage when they put it out for collection.
Because people are still going through the garbage and looking for discarded bills?
Sure. Absolutely.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So you got to shred anything that you feel might be dangerous. Also, as a investigator, we can do what's known as indented impressions. Indented impressions are, you take a yellow pad of paper, right, and now you're writing something down. So you peel that sheet off and you keep it, right? Somebody's address, social security number.
Sure.
What you've written down seven pages, right? So let's say you threw out page seven. I can see what you wrote seven pages above through a technique called indented impression. So you've got to be careful with throwing out any paperwork or anything from a pad that's been written upon, because I can read what you wrote seven pages up. This is how people get their identity stolen.
It's crazy. I mean, I even toss out like medicine bottles with my name and everything on
right.
it. Like it's no big deal.
Yeah, no, you gotta slice the labels up, because that also gives me the ability now to pretext you, right? So let's say you throw out a prescription for Naprosyn, which is, you know, like an Advil.
Sure.
You have some inflammation in your knee, and it's from CVS. You throw the bottle out. So I want to scam you, and I call you, and I go, yeah, hi, this is Joe from CVS, and I know it's pharmacy because it says, you know, 80 Main Street, New York City. And I say, you know, relative to your prescription for Naprosyn, you know, we got a rejection from your insurance company because they said your Social Security was wrong. What's your Social Security number? And you, like a dummy, mm-hmm. you're going to give it to them because I have the legitimate information to make it sound real.
Mm.
So that opens the door for you being scammed, because when it sounds real, you fall for it. So that's the reason why you don't want to toss those things out.
See, you know what it is? The average person like me, I don't even think about it. I'm running out the door, and I'm throwing it out the garbage, and I'm throwing it in the incinerator, and I'm walking out the door.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's why I wrote my book, is to protect people. You know, even those stickers, you know, University of Vermont, that people have on the back of their cars, right?
Yeah.
If I want to call you now, I call up and I say, hi, I'm calling from the University of Vermont, and, you know, we're in the registrar's office, and we're looking to update our records, and, you know, I see here that you attended. And I say, oh, it was my son that attended. Oh, I'm sorry. So they put your name in the wrong box, and let me get your correct date of birth, and what's your son's date of birth? And now you're falling for it, because I know that somebody in your house attended the University of Vermont. So when you think like I do, when you read my book, you'll learn to protect yourself and your family.
How fast can you get me your book?
We'll overnight it to you.
Now, where could the listeners get your book?
Sure. So it's available on Amazon.com. It's available at most Barnes & Noble stores, BarnesandNobles.com as well. And the name of the book is I Spy, How to Be Your Own Private Investigator by Daniel Ribicoff, published by St. Martin's. And it's also in iTunes for a downloadable audio book. It's on Audible.com. You can download the book. It's available in audiobook, Kindle, iBooks as well. So it's published in all the formats, and it's actually been translated into Dutch and into Russian as well. So it's becoming an international sensation. And really, this is not for just anybody who wants to be their own investigator. It's for life skills that you need to know. We talk about
protecting
your valuables.
Safety.
Yeah, we talk about protecting your valuables. You know, hey, where's your jewelry? Oh, it's in my sock drawer in my bedroom. It's in my jewelry box. That's the worst place to keep it, right? Because that's the first place these guys are going to go.
Of course, that's where they're going to look.
Right.
Where should they hide their jewelry?
put your costume jewelry there, and take the real jewelry so they get something, right? And put it into a cereal box in the back of your cupboard.
That's interesting.
They're not going to look there. They want in and out, and the first place they go is the bedroom. Take it in a book, you know, cut the center of a book out with a utility knife and put it in, in the book and put it on the bookshelf. Put it in the bathroom. I had one guy who lifted, you know, the top of the toilet tank up, and he had this container that hung with wires, and he kept his valuables and his jewelry in a waterproof container in the toilet tank.
That's a good one. That's a really good one.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine who was in a cash business. He owned a restaurant, and he would wrap the cash in aluminum foil and put it in his freezer, and then put like his steaks and chicken over it. So,
God, it sounds like something my father would do.
hard
wrap stuff
cash.
In meat and stick it in the freezer.
Hard cold cash, exactly. So if you think like a thief, you know, I'm going straight for the drawers in your bedroom. I'm going for your nightstand. I'm going for your jewelry box. And then I want to get the hell out of there before the neighbors catch me.
Yeah.
So leave stuff out that's bait. Leave stuff out that's not that expensive so they're happy they got something. And then they run out. But the other stuff you want to hide, you know, under the couch, in the living room, you know, you want to cut a little slit into the bottom of the armchair in your living room, you know, the upholstery underneath, and you stick your jewelry pouch in there.
Yeah, no, these are great hiding places.
Yeah, you want to make it hard for them. And they also sell these little safes. You'll find them online. Looks like a can of WD-40, but the bottom screws off. And,
oh, yeah, I've seen those, yeah.
Yeah. So you take it and you put that, you know, under your sink all the way in the back.
Dan, I hate to cut us short a little bit, but we're running close to time, so I just want to ask you one more question. You know, when I first got your bio, actually, it was like 12 pages, and I was like, oh my God. But I knew I'd run out of time. But you're starting your show in London soon, so you want to tell us a little bit about that because we have like 4 minutes left.
Oh, sure. So, yeah, okay. I was contacted by a production company for Channel 4. Channel 4 is the most watched network in England, the United Kingdom, and shot a pilot, and it's going to be a relationship type of show where I'll be using a little bit of polygraph, but a lot of my credibility assessment abilities to interview people, ex-couples, current couples, and try to help them work through the truth. And it's looking like it's going to be called Let's Talk. For the most honest relationship or honest conversation you've ever had in your relationship. And they've ordered 10 episodes, and hopefully they'll be reorder it as the series progresses and gets good ratings. So I'll still be with Steve Wilkos. I'll be working both shows, flying back and forth, and look forward to getting that on British TV.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Shaney.
So now, before we come to a close, is there something that you would like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, never believe anyone. Look at everyone like you're an investigator. Look at them cockeyed. Analyze what they say. Buy my book. Learn my tricks. It'll help to protect you, your family. It also teaches you about how to survive active shooter situations, which is a very important thing today. You can never rule out the threat that we might become you know, involved in a shooting in a movie theater, a mall, or what have you. There's tips there on how to teach your children to survive as well in a school shooting. So what I teach is something that everybody on this planet needs to know. The book is I Spy, How to Be Your Own Private Investigator, published by Daniel Ribicoff.
Wow, this is like some great informative information today. I mean, I have so many other more questions to ask you, Dan. When can you come back?
Anytime you tell me, and we'll make a schedule.
I'm actually going to call your publicist, Sherry Weiss. She absolutely is incredible. She's an amazing woman. I have to say, don't ever give her up.
Oh, absolutely not. Sherry's a wonderful publicist and great.
She is.
The world needs more people like Sherry.
Yeah, she's doing a great job.
Thank you.
So as we come to a closing of the hour here, I want to personally take the time out today, Dan, and thank you so much for joining us here today. I know that you're definitely inspire many people, and I wish you continued success in all your endeavors and the best of luck with your upcoming show. I'm sure it's going to be a huge success as well as your other accomplishments.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Absolutely.
Yeah. It'll be online. You know, they're publishing all these, you know, on demand type of things. So Channel 4 in the UK, I'm sure at one point will have the ability for people to watch it on demand online, and just keep an eye out for it. And if you're ever in the UK, you know, obviously you'll see the show air. It's going to be a primetime show.
Yeah, well, you'll give me all the information, and I'll definitely let all the listeners know, and I'll keep them up to date on everything that's going on with you.
Oh, I sure will. I'll stay in touch with you, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll leave the listeners a little bit on a little inspiration here. The key to happiness and success. It first begins with inner peace, faith, and participating in life. And with those three elements, everything else will always fall into place. So until next week, you are listening to The Best of Health and Fitness. And once again, I am your host, Shaney Rubin. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless you and God bless all the listeners. Be safe.
You too. God bless. I'll speak to you soon, hon. Bye.